Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Astonishing Legends Network.
According to the song by Rodgers and Hammerstein from the musical Oklahoma, the farmer and the cowman should be friends. Oh, the farmer and the cowman should be friends. One man likes to push a plow, the other likes to chase a cow. But that's no reason why they can't be friends. And when you think about it, shouldn't it be the same for the Fortean and the skeptic? Is it even possible? Blake Smith is the host of the Monster Talk podcast, and he's a self-described skeptic. And I think you know how I tend to take issue with a lot of skeptics and so-called skeptical arguments. Well, let me tell you how Blake and I first met. Now, this was back in 2017, on 9/11 of all dates, okay? And Scott Philbrook and Forrest Burgess from Astonishing Legends, they sort of let me in on an email chain. They had been approached by Blake, who was a fan of their show, and he was writing an article about the Kelly Hopkinsville incident. I'm not going to go into it here. But he identified himself as a skeptic, and he was actually asking Scott and Forrest to give his article a read and see if it squared with the research they had done, because they had just done their podcast episode on the same topic. I wasn't quite sure why they were showing me this exchange, but I read the whole conversation between the three of them, which went on a bit, and then wrote back to Scott and Forrest these exact words. I went back and I found the email and I found it. Here's what I said to Scott and Forrest. "You are far too kind. His response is total bullshit." And then Scott texted me informing me that Blake was actually a part of the email chain and had also received my reply. So I, of course, felt like a total jackass and immediately wrote directly to Blake, apologizing for my rude, off-the-cuff, vodka-inspired remark. And then he wrote back to me, super nice, by the way, said he was a fan of the Mothman Prophecies, which, of course, is, you know, the one-step method to get into my heart. And anyway, a correspondence began between us. He invited me to be on his podcast, and the rest is history. The Fortean and the skeptic became friends, real friends. And I think the reason we're friends, and this comes through in the conversation you're about to listen to, is that Blake, not only does he have an honest, sort of open-ended interest in the paranormal, but he also came upon his skepticism in a very human way. He also doesn't use his skepticism as a cudgel to beat anybody down. And best of all, ridicule is just not a part of who he is. Also, the guy's got an amazing book collection. He loves to drink port. He's quick with a pun. And what the heck? He's just an all-around great guy. Now, I don't want to be that guy and say that some of my best friends are skeptics, but as it turns out, some of them are. And I value these friendships so much because it reassures me that I'm not so blind as to not see the human being behind the philosophy. And of course, I'm doubly grateful because they see me too. This is a really fun conversation. I think you're going to enjoy it. Here we go.
Whoa, Richard, that is extra dirty. What is that? What is that? That is so dirty.
Yeah, this is the Hatta Martini. I have demonstrated how to make this on YouTube and Instagram. So can you see the olives?
Oh, how could I miss them? There's barely room for drink.
It's like the sludge at the bottom of a lake.
Yeah,
This thing, you know, it's, and those are blue cheese olives, by the way.
Really? Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. This, okay.
I've developed this over a course of years. I've spent a lot of time figuring this out, but it is half gin, half vodka. And my only rule is that the gin be a London dry gin, just no botanicals to, because that.
Oh, really? There's no juniper.
There's juniper, but that's all there is. Like,
oh,
like,
there's no added botanical. Okay. Gotcha.
Right. Cause there's hundreds of gins now and people get excited about.
And that's not even getting to the Middle East where that means something entirely different.
This is gin with a G, not a DJ.
Yeah. Although who doesn't love a DJ with their gin? Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Wait, there's gotta be a DJ gin out there. Anyway, we're getting away from our topic at hand, which is my drink. So then it is gin. It is vodka. It is, I put in some orange bitters. I put in a couple drops of lemon juice. I put in Dolin dry vermouth blanc and a good amount. I like a wet martini. I'm not going to get into some big argument about, oh, make my martini dry. To hell with that. I want it soaking wet. And then, of course, a big serving of olive juice from the blue cheese olive bottle. I use Mazzetta blue cheese olives. So you put it all together and you've got a drink that 9 out of 10 people will spit out of their mouths. But that 10th person, now you got a friend for life.
And the other 9 will also still be drunk.
just from getting it in their mouth.
Exactly. Your tongue absorbs a lot, right?
So here we are. Welcome to the show, Blake. I am so happy to have you here.
I'm enjoying this mug more than just because it's full of a drink that I enjoy, but I've been drinking the crap out of some coffee in this, but this is my Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf mug. What quality, Richard? What quality? The right? Image is embedded under the lacquer. So it's like, it feels dishwasher safe. Haven't had any fading. It's great.
It's totally dishwasher safe. The one you have, and here's the joke, there's two. The one you have is the one that I physically have in my home that I bring to live events that we sell as merch. But if you go to Fourth Wall, where I sell merch, it's one of those mugs. It's got the logo on two sides, and the inside of the mug is black.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's
is
it's
this a metaphor
different.
Of what's going on in your soul, Richard?
Yeah, that one is. This is not. No, your mug filled with port is a metaphor of what's going on in my soul.
There you go. I love it. I really do. So this is really great. This is not a paid endorsement. I'm a serious mug aficionado, and I'm really loving this mug. So
I'm so happy. Good.
So, and it's got your mug on the mug, which is like a kind of a pun. I don't know if you intended that or not, but yeah.
You know, I'll take what I can get.
Yeah. So
here we are. And I don't know. Now, have you been? Well, I mean, look, there is so much I want to talk to you about.
Sure.
I'm
up to speed on the show, if that's what you're about to ask me. I am.
What?
I'm up to speed on your show.
Well, okay. I was going to ask about communion, but in a weird way, I want to ask about Daniel Cohen.
Yeah, I wanted to show you something. Check this out. So, you know how... when you have an influential book, you want to hold on to it, right? This is the Daniel Cohen book from my youth. Look at my beautiful book binding technique. This is genuine duct tape holding this book. I bought this on maybe in the second or third grade, right? This is The Greatest Monsters in the World by Daniel Cohen. He was always a hero to me. So important. Yeah.
Now, I've got to guess that actually is Monsters, Giants, and Little Men from Mars in a subsequent paperback. Is that Signet?
No, this is all cryptids. So it's got monsters, sea monsters, the Loch Ness Monster, the Yeti, Bigfoot, and dragons. You think it's the same? It might be.
Oh, maybe it isn't. Maybe it's
This is pocketbooks, and this is the 77 Archway edition.
Okay. My guess is, with my limited knowledge of 70s publishing, that this is a cut down version of, because it sounds like all of those things are covered.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, Cohen was like very much he liked to publish for young people and reused his research, I'm sure. Right. So that's very plausible.
Well, and I think that's how books got made then. There would be cut down and abridged versions and retitled versions. A lot of the John Keel books are like, you know, Weirdos from Outer Space. And I'm like, what? I've never heard of that. And then I look at it.
Yeah,
and it's like,
just rebranded. Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is Mothman Prophecies or something. So,
well, I loved your episode about it because... Well, it was well put together. And you talked about Kolchak, which we both love. And but Cohen was so important to me. And I didn't really realize he was sort of soft peddling skepticism, right, in his children's books. And when I went back to look at this as an adult, I was like, oh, my God, he introduced me to so many monsters. And it's been a trigger for so much of my adult research. But I didn't realize not only was he a skeptic, but he was like a skeptic. Like, he was an early founding member of PsyCop. He was real early on in there. And I tried to get him on the show, and it breaks my heart. I must have missed him by a couple of months. He had a massive stroke and wasn't able to do interviews. And his wife was really nice. But, you know, their life entirely changed after Lockerbie,
right,
when they lost their daughter. It was such a nightmare for them. And they basically spent the rest of their life. The way I think about it is, he hunted monsters for the first half of his, you know, adulthood for writing. And then the last part of his life was hunting monsters for justice. You know, he really wanted to fight against terrorism and get some kind of accountability for what happened there. So it just broke my heart. So.
It's tragic in every way you look at it. And it was something that I knew nothing about until a few months ago when I wrote the episode.
Yeah.
And didn't see it coming. And of course, the theme of monsters just repeats and repeats and repeats in that episode. But a lot of these people, when I'm covering the book and preparing an episode, there's always a point about halfway through where I'm like, I better check up on this person on the internet, because I don't know if they've been canceled or if something has happened later in their career that makes them someone I really don't want to be talking about at all, or completely changes the context. And then I found out that story, which I didn't know at all, but you're correct. Yeah. They did. They spent years. And I think that is the tragic sort of burden of many people who lose a child the rest of their life.
Yeah.
The quest for justice through legal means and whatever means are possible.
Yeah. And I mean, I felt so badly for them. I really wanted to talk to, and I was really glad to get to talk to his wife. Even though it was an interview, it was just all email, but I did at least get to pass along my gratitude for him introducing me to so many topics. And, you know, and even in, I think even when I wrote her, I didn't realize his relationship with skepticism.
So strange.
Yeah, it is very strange. So
because in my memory, and I've got a couple of his books on the shelf, these were the books I carried with me everywhere. These were my little totems. Like, well, we're going to a party at, you know, my parents' friend's house, but I can sit in the corner and read In Search of Ghosts, you know? Or the monsters, giants, and little men from Mars. And so many people since the podcast episode dropped have gotten in touch and said, oh my God, I didn't know either. And he was my way in. And now I'm totally into the Fortean Charles Fort, you know, and I had no idea that I was led into the world of monsters by a guy who was low key. And I think it is low key.
Yeah.
Kind of saying, but these things aren't real. So
these things are fun, but
yeah,
there's nothing to really support their existence. Right. And, but when you're a kid, that's not what you read. You read, oh my God, there's monsters everywhere.
right. And here's a grown up writing about monsters.
Yeah. Yeah. So absolutely.
The implicit message is an endorsement of some sort.
It is. Well, I think the entire existence of that section in the library is an endorsement when you're a kid. It's like, oh yeah. My God, adults are into this too. Right. So, I've got a few of these kind of books back here in my library, where it's the, you know, books that were very influential when I was a child, and they're still sources for investigation. One of my recent like deep dives into paranormal culture was the Hairy Hands of Devon, which is a legend about these disembodied hairy hands that will grab someone's steering wheel and cause them to go off the road. And I learned about that from a Daniel Cohen book. It's really obscure, but I drove it to the ground. I feel like I've actually sort of solved the mystery. It turns out it has to do with theosophy and spiritualism and this like really important stuff that was happening in the 1920s that still is super influential, but most people are not really aware of it. Yeah.
I've never heard of this. Where is this happening? Where hairy hands grab your hands on the steering wheel?
In Devon, England. Yeah, you're driving along the moors at night, and then suddenly hairy hands pull the steering wheel and try to cause you to crash.
Do they make you drive on the right side of the road? Or I mean the wrong side?
Yeah. The other side, it's probably just Americans. That's exactly what's going on.
they're demonizing Americans. They're saying a monster with hairy hands makes you drive like an American.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I think you have solved it. Well, it's so funny because now, of course, you're doing Monster Talk. That's the name of your podcast. Yeah. And it is sort of the direct extension of the Daniel Cohen.
It really is. The Daniel Cohen approach, right?
Yeah. I love these things, but I'm coming at them from a skeptical point of view. But it's so funny, Blake, because when I listen to your show, I also don't really feel that coming from you until you make a definitive statement.
Yeah, because you know why? It's often impossible to prove a negative, you know, and my philosophy is one of a tremendous empathy and inclusivity. I love monsters, and I know what it's like to experience something that seems paranormal. I've come down pretty hard in the skeptic camp, but I will never forget what it was like to have my paranormal experiences, and they're just so powerful. And it took so much work to find an explanation that was scientific. And it's not that satisfying, right? It just isn't emotionally satisfying, right? So it would have been so much cooler if instead of figuring out I had sleep paralysis, that I had an exorcism and that took care of the problem. That would have been awesome, right? You know, or maybe if the smudging had worked, or if of the prayers had worked, or if anything had worked, right?
Well, you're getting way out in front. What was your paranormal experience?
Oh, okay. I'll have to give you the short version. Okay. So let me just preface by saying that this tattered Daniel Cohen book will attest, I'm a long time sort of monster person, ghost person. I really have always been interested in the paranormal my entire life. I mean, since forever, like since I was old enough to read, right? So first grade for sure, right? And I wanted to experience.
You're now bragging about how old.
No. I'm just saying
reading.
That
you're reading the first grade. That's great. Okay, it took me to the sixth grade. Blake.
Yeah,
leave me alone.
It's a work in progress, as my wife says. So the. I love monster stories. I love ghost stories. I love to be scared. I was so easily scared. I'm still easily scared. But, you know, growing up, I wanted to not just read about these things. I wanted to experience them, right? So when I learned about Bigfoot, I went out in the woods looking for Bigfoot, you know, and my family had, my grandfather had a huge 360-acre farm. So I got to roam around in near creeks and mountains. And, you know, it's just, I grew up loving rural America, but also feeling like it was probably full of monsters. You just had to find them, right?
Sure.
But I never found them. And I grew up in a world full of ghost stories, but I couldn't find the ghosts. My dad was a carpenter.
So just because you couldn't find them, suddenly they don't exist.
No, not at all. I was still very open to their existence. What actually happened was after a lifetime of strange, you know, intentionally seeking the supernatural and not finding it, I joined the Navy and I went to the Middle East. and I moved into a brand new apartment building up, and I had a penthouse apartment in Bahrain. And this is where the Navy put us because they didn't have enough housing for all the people who were coming over during the Gulf War I. And so I'm in this beautiful apartment. And one night I'd gone to bed and I felt something crawl on top of me and hold me down. And I thought I was being attacked. And so, you know, I'm struggling to try to get out of this. And I throw my covers off and I can see the lump. I turn on the lights. There's a lump under the covers and I'm ready to fight. It's like fight or flight. And oh my God, I was so ready to fight. I pull the covers back and there's nothing there. And, you know, I'm a trained military person. I am ready for combat and there is nothing there. And it just blew my mind. So I didn't know what to make of it. I searched the room. I couldn't find anything. I called into base and I explained what had happened. And the officer on watch or petty officer on watch was like, what do you want me to do, Smith? You want me to put in the logbook that you called in a ghost? And I'm like, no, I do not. So I just sort of had to live with it. And I really didn't know what to make of it. And it happened a few more times. And then I had light bulbs explode and I had doors opening and closing. And I thought, okay, this is clearly a haunting. I've read plenty, Richard. I'd read
right,
plenty.
I knew. Sure.
I didn't really need help to figure out what was going on. I just needed help to figure out what to do about it. So,
and you were like, finally.
Well, you know, I wasn't. I it was intriguing. But at night, I was pretty terrified because it is unsettling as hell to be incapable of fighting back against what feels like a supernatural force.
Right.
Right. And so I thought, well, you know, what do I know about ghosts? Because I'm in Bahrain. This is before the internet. I don't have a library handy, but I've read a lot of stuff. And I'm like, well, clearly I need to get a dog because dogs can see ghosts. And so I get a dog. And sure enough, my dog barks at nothing, which is just very compelling to me. And again, doors opening and closing by themselves. This is absolutely real. And light bulbs start exploding right out of the socket. It's super creepy. This goes on. Well, now I'm thinking I have a haunted apartment, right? I don't know what else to make of it, right? But then I had a relative get sick and I had to go back to the United States. And when I was coming back to Bahrain, I was staying in Philadelphia. And I was in a motel because the Navy really, really puts you up in great places. and it, the same experience happened to me again in the motel where I was being held down and couldn't move. And that was another great moment where I go and I went out and left the room and went to the front desk and asked the guy who was on night watch, you know, I said, hey, has somebody died in the room? Sir, do I need to call the police? I mean, no. I just wanted to know, has somebody ever died in the room? Again, sir, do I need to call the police? No, I just had a strange experience. And I just wondered if, you know, never mind.
Because you nowadays you ask that and they're like, oh, yes, you're in the ghost suite.
Exactly.
There's a separate resort fee for
that. No, this was like 93. They were like, do I need to call the police? Do I need to call the police about you? That's what, yeah, you know, that's exactly the real question.
Shut up,
right?
And get out.
Is there going to be a problem? Right.
Quit maligning our hotel.
So again, to make the long story short, and it is a long story, that, all the way over to getting back to the United States, I was continuing to have these experiences. And then one night, because I still love paranormal stuff, I'm watching paranormal documentaries. And while Mr. Shermer and I are not on the same page presently, I do appreciate the fact that I saw Michael Shermer on a show, and he was describing sleep paralysis. And so I will always have a little place in my heart to thank him for that, because when he described it, I'm like, holy crap, that totally explains the heart of my haunting experience. It doesn't explain everything,
right?
But it explains the heart of that. So
sure.
The other features, first of all, let me just say that as a skeptic, where I've come down on, like, as soon as you decide you're being haunted, you're no longer looking for evidence. You're just finding confirmation, right? So like everything that's weird becomes part of the haunting. It's like, so the real solution to finding the scientific side of things is you don't see the whole thing as a haunting. You try to explain each of the weird phenomena separately. And that it's a different approach, right?
Right.
So if I say, well, the sleep paralysis explains me being held down, which is, that's the sort of explanation behind, you know, incubus and succubus experiences. And what's happening is when you go to sleep, your body's paralyzed. So you don't act out your dreams. But sometimes that gets out of sync so that when you wake up, your body is still paralyzed. And it feels so compellingly like something's holding you down. And even weirder, sometimes you have hypnopompic and hypnagogic dreams or illusions or hallucinations, whatever you want to call them. I've seen shadow people. And they are 100% convincing that there is a shadowy, dark, evil entity. You can feel malignancy coming into the room. It's like it feels so very evil.
So you, I mean, and this has continued on in your life.
Yeah, intermittently. But I can tell you, again, because it's happened to me, I got really interested in the phenomena. And it turns out that the easiest way to cause it, if you're prone to it, is have a weird sleep schedule. Well, it turns out in the Navy, that's extraordinary. You're on watch all the time. So
right.
Our watch was 24 on, 48 off. My sleep schedule was hosed. So I was having sleep paralysis all the time, you know? And then when I got back to the States, I was having it occasionally because I was an IT guy and I would be on night call and I might have to go in at like 2 a.m. for, some kind of maintenance in the server room or whatever. And so I did not have a regular sleep schedule. As an adult, now I'm in my 50s, it's much more rare, but I within the past 5 years I've had it. And it was cool too, because I had a new experience of a little dwarf, a dwarfish sort of ghost skeptic, or what do you call it? Not skeptic, a ghost shadow person. But like little, so it was like a little, you know, hobbit, which was really peculiar. And the weirdest part of that is you wake up, you see this. And like a lot of people, you just go back to sleep. And it's like, it's so peculiar. Like, why would you go back to sleep? Why not get up and investigate, right?
Well, when it happened, once your paradigm changed and you became consciously aware, oh, I am having a hypnagogic illusion and I'm having sleep paralysis, then the next time that it happened, were you like, oh, I'm having sleep paralysis?
Still super creepy, Richard.
But rationally,
what happens is like I feel evil. I feel there's something right behind me. It's so compelling. I'm having sleep paralysis. It's a little small comfort, but you still go through the creepy first, the visceral part.
Yeah, it's like lucid dreaming. It's like, Oh, wait a second. I know what's going on. I'm dreaming.
I wanted to interrogate or investigate the little shadow person more.
Sure.
But sleep wins. Like sleep trumps all your curiosity. Like it's just like you just go back to sleep. It's like the next morning, I'm like, why didn't I get up? Why didn't I move the, you know, whatever and see what was back there? You know, it's like, it's just, you know, you're old enough to remember the little dog chow commercials where the little wagon goes in.
The gravy train.
Yeah, the gravy train. He goes into the cabinet and then they open it up. There's a box of dog food. I always wanted to go look for the little wagon. It's like the same.
Right.
Why don't I get up and look for the shadow person? Because sleep wins. Sleep wins every time.
So here's the thing. So
hold on. Your listeners are going to be wondering, what about the exploding light bulbs? And what about the opening and closing doors?
Thank you. Please.
I get to the sleep paralysis and I never get around to answering those two.
So no, I want to hear it.
Yeah, I lived in an apartment at the top of a penthouse, or like a penthouse at the top of a column. And there was a big gap under the door, like an inch almost. Like it's very, very great. It's a marble floor. The design was beautiful, but there was a big gap there. And there's elevator banks. And every time the elevators come up, a column of air rises. So when the elevators come up, the doors get air pressure and push open. And when the elevators go down, suction pulls the doors close. Right.
Oh, and they weren't latching securely.
Right. Right. So inside the house, like it was causing a pressure differential. Right. So it's that simple in that. But the exploding light bulbs is dumber because I am a cheap bastard. I bought, instead of getting light bulbs on the base from an American store, I bought a big case of them out at the souk market that were from China or something. And they were just really low quality light bulbs. And I even brought them back to the States with me because I bought a case of them. Right. So they started exploding in America too. And I eventually realized that when I got rid of all the incredibly cheap Chinese light bulbs, they stopped exploding with beautiful fireballs.
I just love the notion of you traveling
around with
the
cheapest light bulbs. Yes, yes.
With your light bulbs. Because you know, it's like, well, I spent 75 cents on 100 light bulbs. Well, I'm bringing them with me.
It's so true. This is funny. When you come back from a deployment, the Navy will pay to ship all your stuff to you. So you put it in big boxes, like in big, giant crates. And then it takes months to come back to you. So in this gap, you've got to, like, so I ended up with, like, extra, I had to go buy pots and pans because my pots and pans were on a boat somewhere. I don't know. And so, and when all my stuff came back to me, I'm like, where the hell did I get this? Like, what is this? It was like Christmas from a stranger who had similar taste to me.
Who was I then?
It was. Why did I buy that? Like, it was so weird. But yes, my cheap ass light bulbs came to America.
Okay.
And when I switched to using, I don't know, GE or whatever, like the exploding light bulbs stopped. But yeah.
So, well,
thank you for letting me finish that story, because
thank you for forcing me to let you finish it, because of course the listeners are like, well, now hold on a second. Okay. So the three phenomena that were occurring, you figured out. How did you figure out the elevator thing?
That's just engineering. That's my thing. I mean, it's the kind of thing I was like researching, why would this might happen? And then I got into the idea of air pressure causing doors to open and close. I'm like, holy
Were you noticing? Because I mean, I think people might.
Figure that out until I got back to the state. So like, I couldn't test it. Right? Yeah.
So like, it wasn't like, because you said there was a space under the door.
There was a really.
Sure.
As my dad's a carpenter, when I moved into the apartment, I'm like, I probably would have made that door go closer to the ground.
Right. Well, sometimes, like in my house, there's one bedroom where the door, and this is an older house, at least 70 years old, which in Los Angeles is ancient. It's like a castle. Yeah. But there's one bedroom upstairs that has about an inch, and I could never figure it out until a friend of ours who is the handyman and figures everything out. He's like, this house has been around forever. That room had shag carpet.
Yes, I would have said the exact same thing, because I remember shag carpet. Yeah, you do too. Right. You do too.
Yeah, you can't open the door inward on shag carpet unless there's clearance.
Exactly.
So my question was, did you, when you were in bed or walking around, did you feel air blasting underneath that door, which in America right now would indicate, that's the air conditioning outside.
Yeah.
Blasting in, you know, so, and were you physically aware of, there's a lot of air coming in?
It was really obvious. Yeah. There was a lot of things that happened with the elevators in that apartment complex. There was a lot of weird things, you know, just because it was a different country, a different culture. So but that was real. Yeah.
Me being who I am, I listen to that and I'm like, well, I respect your experience as an individual having had three mysteries, and then you solved three mysteries. So for you, or for, I don't know, for a person, that feels like that would sort of send you down a path of, oh, wait a second. The stuff that I or others may immediately ascribe a supernatural cause to, there might be, if you just kind of track it down a few steps, a fairly rational explanation.
Yeah. But that's not really what turned me into a skeptic. I mean,
it was James Randi and his
charisma. I loved Randi, but you know, feet of clay, man. We could talk about that too, but I really liked Randi, got to know him a little bit. And, but no, what actually turned me into more of a hardcore skeptic was Heaven's Gate. Because
the movie?
No,
look, man, just because they went over budget.
Wow, that's there not, are not many people. Fault. That is amazing. Okay, not many people would make that connection. No, the Heaven's Gate cult in 1997. That's the Apple White UFO suicide thing that happened.
So what happened? What was that?
Okay, so that was when the Hale-Bopp comet was coming through. Marshall Applewhite was a cult leader. And he had a group of followers living in San Diego, and he became convinced that the Hale-Bopp comet was bringing along a companion UFO. And he was running a UFO cult and had been since the 1970s. And if you're old enough to remember this, there were all these different names that the leadership used. There was Tea and Doe. It was Applewhite and Nettles, I think, was his partner name. Together they had, like, it was a very Judeo-Christian UFO cult. And they had been at this for a long time, trying to get people to believe that Christianity itself was tied into like an anti-Luciferian alien story, and that we are spirits in a vessel that can move to the next level. And they were looking for a sign.
I have no problem with this.
Yeah, yeah. So in 1997, with the Hale-Bopp coming in, a guy called into the Art Bell show or a guest that was a remote viewer and said that there was a companion object and it was a UFO. And so Applewhite thought this was a sign, and he used that as the sort of basis of having his entire group leave their vessels. Suicide. They left their vessels behind and went off to the spaceship. That was the idea. So for me, this was a huge psychological blow, because when I started to read about this story, I realized these guys were web developers. They were science fiction fans. They were pretty much just like me. In fact, one of them was Nichelle Nichols' brother. I mean, like, they're really plugged into sci-fi, computer IT stuff.
Nichelle,
like,
Nichols being
Uhura on Star Trek, the original series.
Sure.
Yeah. And so I couldn't understand, how could people who were so plugged into science and sci-fi and all this stuff that I'm interested in go down this pathway that leads them to follow a guy who looks pretty obviously kooky to to drink poison and die? It's like, right. It seemed like, why am I alive and why are they dead? I really got concerned about that. Like, what's the discernment thing here? What's going on there?
So, for a minute, you were almost like, could I, on any level, have bought into this?
Yes, exactly. I really needed to define my epistemology, and I wanted to say, you know what? I enjoy this weird stuff. I enjoy the Fortean. I enjoy ufology. I enjoy cryptids. But I need to know a little deeper, is this stuff real? And so I went on a road trip, and I tried to hit like all these spots and do investigations and try to see, you know, what's the ground truth here? So I went to Gulf Breeze, Florida, which was a hot spot at the time. I went to Roswell, New Mexico. I went to, I actually went to the death house of the San Diego cult. They tried to hide it, but I found it. But it was a good trip. I mean, I did a lot of weird stuff on that trip. And it along the way, I went and saw Robert E. Howard's house. I met Forrest Ackerman and toured the Acker Mansion. I mean, it was a great trip, right?
Yeah.
Coming back, I tried to go to Area 51. That was kind of where things fell apart. It was raining in the desert in Nevada. And I was just like, it was like, there was still like 150 miles to go. And I'm like, I don't know what's in Rachel, but I can't do it. Right.
No, so, you don't want to get mixed up. You don't check out a military facility. Come on.
Well, you could go to Rachel, Nevada. That was back when Freedom Ridge had just been closed down. But we got there so late. It was going to be like 1 a.m. by the time we got to Rachel. There would have been nothing to do there. I'm not even sure we could have gotten gas, but I went back later and I checked that off my bucket list. But, anyway, coming all the way back, I left that trip with the belief that you shouldn't go on legend trips that long, because like when you get to those places, the adventure happened when the people were there. All you're doing is sort of adding a location to your understanding of the story. Like I went to Dealey Plaza. I saw the Kennedy assassination location, right?
Let's be clear. Yeah. You're not considering any of this serious investigation into the paranormal. You were just visiting certain locations.
Yes, absolutely. At that point. Right. Right. Later on, right,
that's
I got
like going,
really
that's like going to the
stuff.
Amityville house and going.
Yeah, absolutely. It's well, a bucket
I,
list.
I stood on the sidewalk and nothing happened, exactly. So it's all bullshit. Yeah. But that you understood. You were not like, this is a place where
I've solved it, right?
Yeah. Right. But you weren't going to an abandoned mental institution in New Hampshire.
Right, right, right.
Kind of thing.
I just wanted to see it. And it's like seeing the UFO museum in Roswell was really cool. I really enjoyed that. You know,
How did you feel emotionally, though? Like, I guess my question is, as this stuff was happening and you were kind of drifting into the center of your philosophy, how did it feel emotionally?
While I was in Gulf Breeze, Florida, I picked up a book by Jan Harald Brundtvand called The Choking Doberman and Others. They were having a book sale to raise money. So as I'm going on this road trip, every night when I'm trying to sleep, I sit down and read Jan Harald Brundtvand's collection of folklore. And I'm like, well, that's weird. I know that story from my hometown. Oh, well, that's weird. That story's from my hometown. Like, I started to realize that the phenomenon of urban legends really sort of, I mean, that wasn't my first exposure to urban legends, but I'd really, it's like, his work is really important. Like, and it was just a coincidence. It was just a book for sale at the bookstore. Like, I mean, at the library, it just randomly created this sort of poetic resonance as I was going along. I'm like, oh, that's not true. Oh, that's not true. Oh, that's not true. And then I'm over here looking at real sites where, you know, ostensibly true things happen. And I think it started to inject a lot of skepticism, but I didn't know anything about Skeptical Inquirer or PsyCop or Skeptic Magazine or any of those things. Those came later, right? Like that wasn't really my world at the time. So I was kind of uncovering like all these reasons to question narratives. But I really hadn't come down firmly one way or the other. So at the end of that trip, I was no more a skeptic than when I left. But within 2 or 3 years, I was firming up to be a pretty hard skeptic. And by the time, and I was alone. I was like, you know, John the Baptist out in the wilderness. I don't know. But
you weren't hanging out at the Magic Castle with Penn Jillette.
No, I didn't know there was a skeptic community. I didn't find, it was almost 10 years before I found out there were other people who had sort of landed in the same place. So I found myself becoming increasingly skeptical, you know, but I didn't really know anybody else. And doubt, it turns out, is a very poor glue to hold people together, right? It's like,
interesting.
Yeah,
okay.
It does not hold a community together. We don't believe that. Oh, we don't believe in that either. Let's all get together and have a potluck. No, wait a second.
But there's the big convention in Vegas, and there's the Magic Castle, and there's the magazine, and there's the. I mean, what is your feeling about all that?
My feeling about that is, and this is a super important lesson, that your epistemology does not separate you from humanity. And part of being a human is disagreeing with every motherfucker who comes along. I took a road trip to Falk, Arkansas, the home of the Boggy Creek Monster. And as we were coming into town, we passed like 8 Protestant churches and then hit a sign. It was like Falk, Arkansas, population 800. I'm like, they have 800 people and 8 different Protestant churches. People cannot agree on anything. Good God.
Wait, now this is very interesting because you grew up in a religious upbringing. Is that correct?
Extraordinarily religious upbringing. Yeah. Yeah.
And where was that? And what was that like?
This was in Cartersville, Georgia. Salute.
Oh, right. No, you're in Georgia now.
Yeah, I am. But I'm in the much more intellectual and I'm in Kennesaw, Georgia, which is different. I mean, we're like 18 miles away from my hometown. So I've been all over the world and somehow landed right smack next to my home. It drives me crazy. I hate
it. Well, you and I first met up in Georgia, in Atlanta. Well, that's at right. Stone Mountain.
It's Stone
years
Mountain.
Ago. Yeah.
Lovely night. Lovely night.
It was so fun. Oh my God, the amount we drank. But where is Kennesaw? How far away from Atlanta? Because that's sort of my point of orientation.
We're about 18 miles north of downtown.
Oh, so, you're right there. You're
right. We're northwest. Yeah. You can't see it from here, but it's real close. Yeah.
Atlanta is sprawling.
It is.
I mean, it's absolutely. Like Los Angeles in that way.
Yeah. No, it's big sprawl. Yeah. Right.
Okay. So you're
unlike Los Angeles. Atlanta goes to sleep at 8:30, 9 o'clock.
If you try to get dinner in LA on a Saturday night past 9 o'clock, you better be going to In-N-Out.
Yeah, well, see, here's Waffle House, but same. Yeah.
Waffle House. So, okay. So you grew up, and what was the denomination or what was it?
We were, we were Congregational Methodists, which was like a conservative offshoot of mainstream Methodists. So it was like a very evangelical, hardcore right wing Methodist, which sounds weird, but that's what it was, right? And so
is Methodist, now you'll have to educate me, is Methodist not considered them a very conservative denomination of Christianity?
No, generally it's not quite Lutheran, but it's pretty liberal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Generally. And were you guys, so I'm guessing you're handling snakes and speaking in tongues?
But amusingly, there were up into the 1980s, only like two snake handling churches in Georgia. One was in my hometown, one was adjacent to my hometown. So yeah, yeah. So we had news crews coming in to film that stuff all the time. Yeah. So, yeah.
So you grew up believing in a narrative
of a wrathful
soul in the other world.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And what exactly was it that you were specifically going to hell and there was no question?
Oh, yeah. It was, I mean, like my wife's Lutheran. So she's as she calls it Catholic light, which is pretty fair. So, when I was in the Navy, I toyed with the idea of flipping to Catholicism and decided not to. But it's like Catholic or atheist. Those important life choices.
You were looking for something to believe in.
Yeah, exactly. So I really like a lot of what Jesus had to say, you know. But growing up, it was if you sin and die with sin on the books, you go to hell. Which is pretty hardcore. So like, I mean, I was in terror of dying and going to hell. Like, it's right. Like it was constantly praying for forgiveness for mistakes. Like it was.
And you're a kid, you're 8 years old.
Yeah, no, right. Exactly. No, it's not a healthy way to grow up. I'll be honest with you. It's a terrifying way to grow up. And it was all true, Richard. It was like, everything was real. Like the Bible was literally true. Everything was literally true. Up to and including the talking donkey. Like it's all in there, right? So You're just supposed to believe all of it. And as an adult, I'm like, well, that story contradicts that story. And it's like, well, you know, the inerrant word of God, Richard, you know, there's no mistakes in the Bible. And I'm like, You know, this really makes no sense. But if you are willing to, you know, eat that cookie, you know, Or whatever you want to call it, and just accept that, it's easy. It's simple. And there's answers for everything. You know?
And you're living in a family and in a community. And these are your friends and Your family and your family's friends. And you like them and they're nice people. And That's the world you live in.
Exactly. And that was a scary world. Because as a kid, I took it all very seriously. Right. Sure. I mean, I took it all extraordinary. And my parents did. And what I realized as I was growing up is that my parents were very literal, very serious about it. And a lot of people weren't really. Like a lot of people really weren't that serious about it. Like my dad would get very frustrated because, you know, he couldn't become a deacon. Like to become a deacon, you have to kind of be voted in by the other deacons. And they were business people and community leaders. And my dad was just like an evangelical firebrand and they didn't really want him in their group.
he believed too hard.
Yeah, exactly. He was like, he believes this stuff, right? You know, it's like, it's like they don't want that. They don't want that level of engagement, right? So he's been frustrated his whole life that he took it so seriously and that people just didn't. Hypocrisy still burns me really badly. Like no matter what it is, it's like, if you don't really believe this stuff, then don't say it. Like don't lie, you know, Say what you mean. Right. So,
well now are they still, did that make him decide to hell with this or?
No. They're still very evangelical. They still very much believe all this is real. Now they're facing death and it's very heartbreaking to me because they seem afraid to me, or they seem very concerned and afraid. And over the course of my life, I've faced death a few times and I found myself in a place of pretty good peace. Like I was like, you know, I thought I was going to die. And I'm like, you know what? I'm okay. My wife's got the kids. Like, it's all okay. Right. So I know how it's going to go. Like, I don't want to die in pain, but I'm not worried about dying. So, yeah.
So if I'm, let me just read this back to you and tell me if I've got it. Mm-hmm. Their devotion to this religion has actually led them to a place of being more worried about what happens after death than less. Yes. And your stepping back from it I honestly don't know.
I'm not an evangelical. My personal feeling is that there's nothing after we die. Right.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. So your personal feeling is you die and that's just, you're unplugging the TV and you're done.
Yeah.
And you, and that to you, emotionally to you, that does not give you the fear that they have.
No more than going to sleep gives me fear. Right. Yeah. Yeah. But I actually think I have an understanding of that. Because I was talking, I have another evangelical in my family. My brother-in-law is evangelical. And we were having a discussion. I said, you know, Steve, you're evangelical. I feel I'm a little surprised that my family, my parents are so worried about death. And he just said casually, well, they probably never thought they were going to die. And I'm like, I don't know if you can see, because it's a podcast, you can't see the shocked look on my face. I'm like, oh my God, Steve, you're absolutely right. Right. Because when did we grow up, Richard? We grew up in the age of Hal Lindsey and the late great Planet Earth. You remember that?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is the idea that we were living in the end times was constantly in the evangelical news. My mom fully explained. They never thought they were going to die. They were going to rise up into heaven in the rapture.
They were going to rapture. Yeah,
and they are so disappointed that they're actually facing death. They never thought they were going to die. And now they're in their 80s and it's hitting them. Oh, crap. We're going to die. I mean, heaven's still out there for us, but we wanted to go flying up in the sky and show the losers who was winners, right? You know, it's like,
Oh my gosh. Okay. But now I'm so sorry. I'm so ignorant about the specifics of various rules.
You live in LA. Why would you know?
Well, you know, and I talk about this a little, but I'll reiterate it now. I was brought up with no religion. I did not go to church. Now, this does not mean that my parents were atheists. My father was a Catholic. I was actually baptized Catholic to please my paternal grandfather, but we never went to church. My mom was really into Mary Baker Eddy and Christian Science.
Wow. Christian Science, yeah.
But there was no... a church ritual, and church was not a part of our social community, and so I was kind of left to my own devices. Did my parents teach me the Lord's Prayer, and did we say our prayers at night? Yeah, we did for a few years.
Yeah,
until my parents, you know, got bored, and my mom was watching Carol Burnett, and you know, it didn't happen. So I was left to my own devices, which then as ghosts came in and UFOs and stuff like that, just as a kid living in the world, that filled my philosophical cup. And that became my question. And, you know, it's like, well, are these things real? And one of my best friends, when I was a little kid who was also interested, was very religious. And he was always telling me, and it's so funny when you're kids, he was always telling me, well, you know, if you, the way you go to heaven when you die is to believe in Jesus. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? And he's like, well, you've got it. If you believe in Jesus, you do this and you do this and you do this. And I was like, well, what if you just do those things, but you don't believe in Jesus? He's like, nope, you don't go to heaven.
Yeah.
And even as like an 8-year-old, I'm like, well, that doesn't seem fair.
Yeah. Well, that's orthodoxy versus orthopraxy, right? So it's,
I was going to say that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is your religion what you do, or is your religion what you believe, right? So yeah.
But that's a thing though.
Yeah.
Is it works or is it faith?
Yeah,
because
exactly.
You give, if you don't believe, but you give millions and millions of dollars to the church, does that make up for it?
Well,
because those are works.
If you'll indulge me for a moment.
Please.
that's the whole thing about indulgences. It's basically buying a pass, right? So,
sure.
Which led to the Protestant Reformation, right? And
wait a second, but Blake,
yeah.
if you're very, very rich,
yeah,
and you give all your money to the poor, and you give all your money to the cancer research hospital, and you give all your money, that's, I mean, you're but you don't believe that, that's you're still doing all the right things. So you still go to heaven, right? I guess I'm asking you.
I'm afraid not.
You go to nowhere because you're an atheist and you just
well,
die.
No, I'm just saying you go to hell because according to Jesus, it's easier for a camel to travel through the eye of a needle. A needle than for a rich man to go into heaven, right?
So, but what if you're not rich anymore because he gave all your money to the poor?
Well, so it really doesn't matter according to Christianity. Like, it's like if you don't believe that Jesus is the Son of God and also is God, that it, you know, the Trinity, the mystery of the Trinity,
right, yeah, the Trinity, right?
You don't really make it to heaven. So, if you believe Jesus came and died for your sins, that he was God made manifest in flesh and that he died on your behalf. If you believe that, then according to Christianity, you go to heaven. Now, that says nothing to all the other religions of the world or the billions of people who believe them, right?
And sure.
Like many things in my life, statistics becomes more important than anything else, right? It's like how many really cool supernatural stories disappear in a puff of statistics, right? It's a lot, right?
What do you mean?
Well, what I mean ultimately is
I think it's almost the opposite.
But really? That's it. It's the tough thing, right? So, like, I frequently am bothered by the idea that my skepticism of the supernatural comes down to a category problem, right? So, in science, you want things to be testable and repeatable, but that is really not generally the nature of supernatural events. They're stochastic, they're random. They happen to people fairly rarely, and most things are not supposed to be repeatable. Like that's different from, say, psychic phenomena where people are psychic. But even in psychic phenomena, most psychics don't say that they're 100% accurate all the time. It's some percentage, right? So they have their weirdly accurate predictions sometimes, and then the other stuff isn't, right?
Right.
And so when you apply statistical analysis to these sort of things, really cool stuff can just evaporate. And it's so disappointing.
It's only important if science is the only yardstick you use to measure reality, because there seems to be this argument that it's like, oh, well, you're anti-science because, you know, you believe in tarot cards or something.
That's a great example, though. Yep.
But it's like, well, but what if science is great for measuring certain things? It's an incredibly valuable tool for certain things, but not for 100% of human experience.
Are these things like they don't really fit into science because you can't repeat them and measure them? Right. Right.
Right.
And so science will never prove the existence of ghosts. Right. Because they literally don't make sense scientifically. Like there's no way to met, like people break out their ghost hunting equipment or whatever, but
I know.
Yeah, but
it kills you a little bit,
but I'm still incredibly sympathetic to people, not in a pitying kind of way, but like in a no, seriously, I know what it's like personally way. If you have a haunting, it's incredibly plausible and believable because your senses are telling you it really happened, right?
Right. And you're living proof based on your lived experience.
Exactly, right. And so you're not going to hear me tell
an experience that you then figured out. So which is so fascinating, and I love it. And I want to talk, in 1 second, I'm going to circle back to an episode of yours that I listened to. But I love sort of talking to human beings about their experiences and valuing it without having to endorse it, which I think is what you're doing.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, what Karen and I, my co-host Karen Solzno, have come down on what I like to call the presumption of sincerity. Like, so when someone tells a story that they saw Bigfoot or they saw a ghost or they saw a monster, some of them are going to be hoaxers, right? Sure. But I like to believe most people are sincere, right? And so, you know, Joe Nickel passed away this year. He was a mentor to me. I loved his work. And, you know, he always looked for a natural explanation. Sometimes maybe there was no reason to look for a natural explanation. Maybe those stories don't really make any sense, or it doesn't matter Because no matter what happened in those investigations, Joe always treated the people who he was talking to with respect, which I appreciated, right? I have probably more empathy for experiencers than a lot of my colleagues. I think skepticism tends to attract the kind of people who are very rational. There's probably a disproportionately large number of autistic people in our community.
Really?
And, oh, golly, yes. Yeah. I mean, yes. Golly, yes. Yeah.
Why is that?
I could only speculate. I mean, I'm a parent of autistic kids. So I don't identify myself as being on the spectrum. I'm a person who grew up in IT culture, so I work with a lot of autistic people, and I love sci-fi, so I run into a lot of autistic people. Statistically,
okay, so IT and sci-fi are where the autistic people go.
Yeah, so I don't. Blake Smith, I can't you heard really it here count, first. But there are a lot of autistic people in the skeptic community, and it's not that autistic people don't have empathy. They certainly do, but they may not be able to pick up on some of the social cues. And sometimes they get hyper-focused on true or false or binary analysis of stuff.
Okay.
And my landing is that the humanity and narratives are more important than the binary question of whether this really happened literally exactly like it was told.
And I think science is a ruler that is binary.
It is a binary filter. Exactly. Right. Exactly. So there's not a lot of place for empathy or understanding or wiggle room. I don't know, in science. It is that's not what it's for, right? You know.
Well, so. What was fun for me to discover in listening to an episode that you did that was sort of and Joe Nickel was featured in it. And the people I'm going to, or the person I'm going to refer to, unfortunately, you'll remind me of their name. The episode itself was sort of a reexamination of Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Oh, the Warren omission.
The Warren omission, which is a hilarious pun, and I love it.
Steve Novella, maybe?
He was the young skeptic who.
Yes, Steve Novella. He's a doctor. He's a brain scientist up in New England. Yeah.
Yeah, so. And so here's what I loved, and I want to tell the audience that you were talking to him, and he was talking about when he was like just post college, and he and a friend of his were skeptics. They sort of discovered that they were on this is not rational side of the fence. Okay. Yeah. And what was so fascinating to me was listening to him say, well, it was sort of the 90s and the internet wasn't really a resource at that point. And so, you know, we would have to go find magazines, you know, that sort of talked about our interest. And then we discovered that there were a lot of skeptic groups in the Northeast, but there wasn't any in our specific area. So we decided we were going to be those people. We were going to be the investigators. And so then we start put the word out that if you've got a haunting or something, and I'm like, this sounds exactly like every ghost hunting group.
Exactly the same. Yeah.
Except
yeah.
the opposite.
except the opposite. Exactly. Right.
And I found it was so charming and sort of like humanity affirming that it's like, well, you know, you find the thing that interests you. You find other people, you know, who kind of like stamp collecting or ghost hunting or ghost debunking. And then that's the fun thing that you do. And that becomes your thing. And I'm like, God, it's like literally the trajectory is exactly the same.
Yes. Yeah. There again, I feel like I have so much more in common with people who have these experiences than the other way, right? I don't see them as others. I see them as me. We have so much in common, but I've just landed in this world of skepticism. Like it's not the community. It's the methodology, right? And I can't help it, right? Like I can't help but think, well, is there any, because I really do believe there's a real world and it's interact. Like, I think there's, I guess I'm a hard materialist, which is strange. Like,
you never told me that.
Yeah, I really believe
on the show.
Yeah, it was great. It was great talking with you, Richard.
It was great being friends with you.
I feel like there is a material world. I listen to so many different opinions.
Of course
opinions.
There's a material world, though. That's the thing that drives me crazy is this sort of thing. Like if your worldview allows for phenomena that appears to be the way it appears to a naked observer to be partially physical and partially non-physical, which is a fucked out thing that we have no metaphors for. Does that mean that you don't believe in gravity and you don't believe taking an aspirin and you don't believe in? No, it's always, to me, it's a matter of all of that plus this other shit we haven't figured out yet that may be in an area right now that for us is magic.
Yeah. Well, which would be the best, like, wouldn't it be great? Like, do you think I wake up some days and and I'm so happy that I've solved everything and it's a material world and, you know, I have a rational explanation for everything. No,
you sound like Madonna.
I want there to be magic. I want this stuff to be true. I would love for Bigfoot to be found. I would love for ghosts to be proven. I would love for ghosts to show up in my life in the way that they seem to for other people, right? But
you know, there's more and more scientists sort of going, we might not be living in a fully physically manifested
universe. Well, I was
going
to tell you, I'm rage listening to an audiobook right now called The Case Against Reality by Donald Hoffman. I had to look up the title.
Huh. I don't know the book. Don't know the guy. Go ahead.
No. But he's one of those people who are like, maybe we're in a simulation, Richard. Maybe this is a simulation. Right. And it's like, I'm like, well, as an IT guy, I'm like, no, we're not living in a simulation, you moron. I mean, it's like, what are you talking about?
Is he literally saying we're literally in the future, someone built a video game and that's what we're in?
It has to do so much with video games, Richard. Really, it's like, well, I played Grand Theft Auto and it looks pretty realistic. Maybe that's what's going on. I mean, it really does feel like it's so bad. He took a TED talk and expanded it into a real full length book.
Oh, wait, I think I do know the guy you're talking about. I think he was just on the telepathy tapes.
It could be. I don't know. But I find it like I'm rage listening to it because I feel like we could have a nice debate and I would crush him. And that's not my style. Like, I really right. don't like to crush people in debates, but I can.
but I think what's happening is that, you know, you and I live in a house and you've counted all the rooms in the house. And there's certain people who are like, but there's this other room you're not aware of. And you're like, then show me the room.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, where is it? Where's this at?
You got it. The room isn't always there. And you got to be willing to believe in the room.
Yeah, it's Carl Sagan's Invisible Dragon he loves to joke about. So, right. Yeah.
But here's the thing. You'll laugh at me, but I have no other language to sort of explain my point of view, which is, you know, it would take anyone about 30 seconds to explain that there's no way on earth that I could be in love with my wife.
Well, what is love? Baby, don't hurt me.
Wow, your wife showed up fast.
That's one of those things. It's like, if you're a scientific person, you could say, well, we know what love is because you can see these chemical reactions. If you do an fMRI, you can see which areas of the brain light up when you know, it's like,
there's some websites tell you that show what happens.
Right. That doesn't tell you anything about what love is. Right. It's like, you know, I'm a materialist. Let's just say hypothetically that I took a mushroom and then made love to my wife and she turned magenta when I climaxed. It's just hypothetically. But it's like,
are you giving us information right now?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just saying, like, what if that happened? Right. You know, does that mean something magical or does it mean that my perception was being messed with by mushrooms? I don't know, Richard. That's just a hypothetical. But, you know.
Look, what in your own time is your business, Blake.
Your magical moments are they're your personal magical moments, right? I mean, that's I, I like I don't believe in a God, but I know what it means to experience the sacred. I know what it means to experience the numinous. It doesn't take away from my experiences to have this dependency on a scientific explanation. So,
but let me ask you this. If, because, and you know, consciousness, you know, and I'm saying the word, is now kind of the fulcrum word. And
yeah, it's the hard problem of consciousness, Richard. You got to say it that way, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, the hard problem of, look, the fact that it's a problem at all is, yeah, you know, gives me a little.
I wish this was being videoed because they're like, what? You know,
I'm like, I'm grabbing my collar.
Yeah, the hard. We're very cartoonish over here.
Okay. So if it became known, even though, and it's funny because you're the one who kind of said this, that like we use a lot of technology that we don't really understand how it works, but it does. So we're putting it out there, we're making money on it, but we can't, if you gun to the head, we can't really explain
right.
it.
Right. No, that's increasingly true. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess my point is, if we came to understand as a culture or a world culture that consciousness was not an artifact of biology, but did exist sort of generally and as our individual bodies die, our individual consciousnesses go and join the big whatever, that doesn't threaten anything. That does not mean that 2 + 2 does not equal 4. That doesn't mean that rockets don't fly. That doesn't mean cars don't run. That doesn't mean cell phones don't work. And it doesn't mean gravity doesn't exist. So why is it such a bugaboo?
Good question. It bumps into problems of what is consciousness, right? That, I guess that's real. To me, that's the big thing, right? You can't, so like people are like talking right now, the big hot topic is AI, right? First of all, that's terrible. Don't call that AI. What we have now is large language models. And when you hear people say, well, they're just predictive text on steroids, that's absolutely true. They're not smart. Like you can actually have a sort of conversation with them. And from sentence to sentence, they're sort of recreating, like every interaction is a new interaction on its own, right? So, but it's incredibly compelling, isn't it? Have you messed around with them at all?
Not much. I just, okay. But I haven't really needed to.
I mess around with them a lot. And they are, it's not that great of a technology. It can do some interesting things, but Alan Turing years ago argued that if you could fool a human being with a computer, that the computer would be really indistinguishable from life. And it turns out what he didn't understand was that humans are incredibly easy to fool. Like it's like,
God damn it. It always comes back down to your magic castle.
It's like my parents get fooled by dumb bots calling on the landline. I mean, it's like, it's really easy to fool people, and it's really disappointing how easy it is to fool people. Right. And believing, even understanding how that works doesn't make you immune to being fooled. We're really susceptible to being fooled. And there's been some very troubling and disturbing research in psychology that has sort of shown that our narratives that we think of as consciousness, the stories we tell ourselves about why we do things, often happen after we've taken the actions that we think are our own choices. And the implication is that, well, maybe, our consciousness isn't real. Maybe we don't have self, like the idea of free will is illusory. I'm more inclined to think that our understanding of what our own consciousness is flawed because we're in it. You know, we can't know what part of it is happening. Like the actions we take, I think are based on our brains. I think the actions we take are tied to the sort of mental models that we've developed, our values and all that sort of thing. But that the narratives that we think of it as consciousness happen after the fact. So like our character defines our behavior and our consciousness narrates it, I think is basically, boy, that sounds really cogent. We should write that down.
I know that's, don't worry. This is being, oh, I forgot to record this. Hang on. Let me press the button. Well, what you're saying is, I mean, it's the same question.
Yeah.
It's, you know, am I me or am I just a bunch of, you know, reactions.
Well, we know, like, you're not one cohesive thing. I mean, the you that is you when you're sober is different from the you that you is you when you drink, right? I mean, that, like, you start
to back it off.
Yeah, yeah. And when you get high, or when you take a shroom, or there's all kinds of.
I haven't done any of that stuff.
Blake. No.
How
I'm just saying,
talking like, about
hypothetically, if you were to take these medicines, they change the way you interact with your own senses. Like they create.
But that's because it's a physical thing affecting a physical organism.
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
No one's arguing that there's no physical. You're in a physical thing. Yeah. If I lose my arm, then I don't have an arm.
I'm just saying that you have senses, and then you have cognition to sort of understand what your senses are telling you, and that system is vulnerable to hacking from a lot of vectors, right?
Because it's still physical. Once you shed the physical body,
well,
with Professor Applewhite,
you
will come with me.
If it turns
pure
out
understanding,
can you imagine how happy I would be to find that when I shed this physical body, my consciousness continues to exist? It would be the best thing in the world. It would be the best thing in the world.
Well, right? that's a bit, but see, to me, that's like a rhetorical riposte.
Yeah.
It's very easy for me to say the scariest thing in the world is alien abduction phenomenon.
Yeah, which brings us back to communion. Well done, Richard. Well done.
But it's very easy for me to say, God, you know, I would sleep so much better at night if I knew that everything was explainable with a certain tool. And that I didn't have to wonder about things and worry about things and be curious about other people. And it would be so nice to dismiss what people say about things they experience that involve things I might not understand. I would give anything to be an atheist. It would be I'd be so much happier just to know that all questions can be answered by science, and then I can just go to sleep at night.
I do sleep like a baby, but that's not why.
You son of a bitch.
I wasn't joking when I called this back to communion, because Strieber would have you believe from the book cover that that's a book about aliens. But ultimately, that's a book about what happens when we die. I mean, it really is. Like, all of his research really comes down to, this is about death. This is about the continuance of consciousness, right? So,
my friend, you are 100%. Do you know who Joshua Cutchin is?
Oh, yeah, I know Josh. He lives in Georgia. Yeah,
he does. Yeah. Oh, the three of us got to get together.
No, that would be awesome. We should totally do that. Yeah, I like Josh a lot. So, yeah. But his book, what is it? He's got several, but the about the feast, he talks about eating fairy food, and he's
the Trojan Feast,
and he's got his other stuff. Oh my God, I can't remember the name of the book. I'm in the wrong room. I've got my library over here to the other room, but he's got several books. But his whole thing is about these incredibly fringe experiences people have, and there's all these commonalities to them. And these are not people who are well-read into Fortiana or any of this stuff, but you find these same motifs appearing again and again across these stories.
His latest book is such a mind fuck, because it's called Fourth Wall Phantoms. And it starts out being about people who experience fictional characters.
That is so funny. Okay. I have to get that one for sure.
I'm reading it, of course, with many books. There's always that section where I'm like, okay, I am now so far out of my depth. My head is covered in water and I'm going to drown, because I just can't quite follow the theoretical thrust. But now I'm coming back up. But it's a fascinating book, because then it just gets into, well, what is fictional and what is not fictional, and how do our lives follow narratives, and how do we understand our lives through the idea of narratology? And it gets, you know, it gets into that sort of
stuff. That sounds right up my alley. So I'll have to add that to my
collection. He uses the word metalepsis, and it scares me.
That's interesting. Metalepsis, right?
Metalepsis. But he'll, you know, you can check it out. But anyway, okay, yes. So go ahead with what you were saying about communion, because that's what he says. He wrote three books the Ecology of Souls on the notion that the UFO phenomenon is inextricably connected to the afterlife ideas.
Yeah. And I think many skeptics just dismiss Strieber as a UFO guy. And it's like, no. He's way more metaphysical, right? It's way more metaphysical. And I mean, so much of that has to do with his wife's influence on his interpretation. She was handling the letters that all the people wrote in. Yep. After writing Communion. And if you ever listen to Dreamland, you know, he used to guest host on Coast to Coast and do the Sunday Night Dreamland show. And it was a lot of that was about this continuous of consciousness. And it's not about aliens from other planets. It's about aliens in their relationship to the idea that souls are these entities that exist beyond our body. So, you know, he's asking questions. He's not answering them. And that's a valid way to approach this material. So,
we talk about it all the time, but we're getting into an era where we're not siloing off ghosts from cryptids from UFOs.
Yeah. And no, my colleague Jeff Card, he calls it the paranormal unified field theory, right? This idea that there's like this narrative structure or there's so much overlap between these materials, even down to cryptids. Like it really is, there's something else going on. Now, Jeb's not as skeptical as I am. It's not a contest or anything. I just landed in this weird, hardcore skepticism.
Isn't there a Skeptic of the Year contest that you have competed in?
I am on the calendar, but I didn't win, Richard. I didn't win.
I see. Okay. Hey, you know, it's an honor just to be nominated.
But it's really hard to be where I landed. I'm not fond of it. I am where I landed. It's not great. It's a lonely place.
Now it's a lonely you're, as you speak to me from your basement.
Yeah.
you're in a lonely place. I get it.
Come on, Hulk, help me out here.
The Hulk is behind him. Okay. So thought experiment question for you. Is there any experience that you could imagine that would change your point of view?
Yes. Yeah, sure. What absolutely.
Describe what that might be.
Okay. I would love to have a ghost interaction. It would be really cool if a ghost appeared and told me something that I could then write down and then go verify. That one's cool. I like to write fiction, and I've imagined a sort of short story where a guy is doing, you know, I hope you haven't had, I know you actually have had the experience of having a relative who's on the way out, like who's dying, right? Yeah, not pleasant. I had that experience with my grandmother where, you know, she was dying of cancer. She was 100 years old. She was not going to make it. And
why don't you hit the mic a few more times?
Boop, boop, boop. That's what it's not a spit. It's a don't make a noise when you slap it is what that is. I don't know. I had this idea of a story where a guy wanted to reconcile with his father, but he's on death watch, but he can't, he's so anxious, he can't sleep. So he takes an Ambien and he knows the problem with taking an Ambien is you don't remember things, you know, like you go into there's like a real problem with memory after you take an Ambien.
Oh, right.
And his father comes and stands next to him while he's in bed and starts talking to him. And he's like, you know, he wants to reconcile with his father, but his father is not speaking. But now his father's suddenly standing next to the bed and he's like, I just wanted to tell you, I forgive you. You know, like, I'm not mad at you or whatever. And he's like, this is so important to me, Dad. You know, I'm not going to remember this because I took an Ambien. He's like, well, write it down. So he writes down the whole experience. And then the next morning, his father's dead. But when he looks, he's got this notes next to the bed where he's like written down that his father came and told him but his father can't walk. There's no way his father came and talked. It's a great idea for a story. It would be such a cool ghost story. Yeah.
But what's written down? What does he see?
Well, what's written down is his father came and spoke to him.
Which it is the thing.
He wrote it down. It's like, nobody's going to believe this. And was it the Ambien? I don't remember this happening, but I've got this whole story of my father coming and telling me he forgives me. I don't know what to make of it. It's sort of that Rashomon kind of, I love the idea of it. So
I love that. And I love that these are questions that you and I can ask and can have fun talking to each other about. I never would have imagined it. And yet here we are, as Rodgers and Hammerstein said, the cowman and the farmer should be friends.
They should be friends. They should. Well, we have so much in common. I know there are people who just want to dismiss everything, but I'm a hard skeptic who loves the paranormal. I love these stories. I want them to be true. The fact that I can't believe them has no bearing on the story. Like, it has nothing to do with anything. I when people have these lived experiences, I'm so respectful of that. I absolutely am. You know, not a fan of scammers, not a fan of people who rip people off.
No.
But the honest inquiry into the supernatural, I'm 100% behind. Yeah. So.
And I love that you're open to the notion that, you know, God forbid one day you do have a near-death experience and that might add to your overall philosophy.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. So I want to believe that I'm always open to change, like always open to new evidence, always open to new experiences. So, yeah.
And I want to believe that I'm not a totally gullible dupe who believes. But I always say, you know, I don't believe in any of this stuff because none of it has ever happened to me.
Yeah.
And I think that does influence what I would call belief.
Well, I hope if anything does happen to you, it's more pleasant than what happened to me.
What, an exploding light bulb?
Exploding light bulbs, weird shadow people. I mean, I've come to peace with it all, but it's not anything I would wish on anybody. I mean, it you know, just because I believe it has a natural explanation doesn't make it pleasant. It's peculiar. It's weird. It's spooky.
All right. Well, in conclusion, I reach my flesh and blood hand out to your cold, cold, metallic, robotic, cybernetic hand. We reach across the gulf of question and belief and mystery and fact and reality, and we join in brotherhood, Blake.
Absolutely. So I love that our curiosity and openness is our commonality. That's the most human thing of all, right?
All right, man. You're going to come back one day?
Absolutely. Are you joking me? I love talking to you guys. It's awesome.
I'll come over on your show too. I love you.
You should do that. So, all right. Have a good night, Richard. It was great talking to you once again.
All right. Good night, man. Bye.
See you.
Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Please join us next time when we look into the future with Sam Knight's The Premonitions Bureau. But then, you already knew that, didn't you? Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.